When he passes the serving bowl of creamy red curry to me over the table in the Thai restaurant, I don't know that this second date will be our last one. What could go wrong? Both of us are clergy serving congregations. We talk about seminary experiences, mine longer ago than his. He's from a Trinitarian Christian denomination that allows gay clergy. But otherwise, I'm finding out he's rather traditional and full of strong opinions. He asks about Unitarian Universalism. Maybe you know my answer. In the United States, both sides of the family came out of New England Calvinism. Unitarians rejected the doctrine of human depravity, and they saw Jesus as a human being only. And the life of Jesus demonstrates the beauty and possibility in every person. The Universalists, on the other side of our family, rejected the ideas of heaven for only an elect few and hellfire for the rest of us. God is love, they said, and salvation is universal. And then I tell him about the seven principles, although I can't really tell him all of them because I don't have them memorized, but I get the job done. And I survive this round of questions. And then he asks me, what is your worship service like? More or less Protestant in structure, I say, reflecting our heritage. Next, we're talking about favorite hymns. I say, we have some of the same tunes as you'll find in Christian hymnals, but we've changed some of the words. For example, the tune Nicaea. You know, holy, holy, holy. We have three texts for that tune in our hymnal. We took out references to the Trinity in two versions of that hymn and took out God from a third one. I thought it was funny. He didn't. What? He shrieks. That's what it's about. The Trinity. You can't change the words. You should go write your own songs. Knock yourselves out, Unitarians. But stealing Nicaea, that is outrageous. He rants on for a while in this unapproving way. I can't even get a word in to say, well, we do write some of our own songs. So the handwriting is on the wall for us. But I've already bought the theater tickets. When the bill comes, he says, let me buy dinner. It's the least I can do. After insulting me, I reply, yes, this is our last date. He was mad that we had written new songs for that famous Trinitarian tune. I didn't have the nerve to tell him that we also sing a parody by the name of Coffee, Coffee, Coffee. But it's not in the hymnal. It's not, you know, like public. And I didn't say that, you know, you could blame all of this on the Protestant Reformation. Starting 500 years ago, it set religion in the Western world on the slippery slope of innovation and upheaval. Once people go outside the familiar embrace of age-old rules and structures, you never know how things will turn out. The Protestant Reformation began in Western Europe in the early 1500s. Yet, as Alistair McGrath has written, the leaders of it did not know they were in a Reformation. They didn't even know they were in Europe. That is, the modern concept of a nation state with clear borders had not yet emerged. Kingdoms and principalities were organized by language and culture. People knew themselves by local identities, not as whole nations. And in that continent of kingdoms, the one unifying institution was the Catholic Church. Yet over time, the church's forays into power politics, its wealth, and the extravagant lives of its bishops and popes began to weigh on people. As the church degenerated spiritually, as it strayed far from the gospel values of Jesus, there was, nevertheless, a rising interest in personal religion and personal spirituality among the people. Levels of literacy grew among French, Dutch, Italian, German, and other peoples. The new technology of printing made the Bible available to ordinary Catholics, available in translations that they could read. Families and neighbors could wrestle over the meaning of Scripture and compare it with what they heard and saw in the church. If they couldn't find the divine in church anymore, they could connect with God in their own prayers and through their own Bible. The printing press made other books available too. A mega bestseller of the Renaissance was entitled The Handbook of a Christian Knight, written by the Dutch scholar Desiderius Erasmus, along with spiritual advice and moral advice useful to knights and peasants alike. It criticized the church. In addition to having books at hand, more people tried out and practiced local forms of religion, that is, non-church rituals that were focused on the daily struggles of peasants, such as their hopes for the weather, their needs for a successful harvest, and their prayers for the survival of infant children. While most folks worried about staying alive, the church exploited the reality of death. It sold indulgences, relics, and other items. In buying an indulgence, a grieving family could guarantee that the soul of their dearly departed would go to heaven, would leave purgatory and go to heaven. The church even had advertising slogans. One slogan went, "As soon as the coin in the coffer rings, a soul from purgatory springs." All of this was too much for Martin Luther, a monk from a peasant German family. He had quit law school to pursue theology. He became a monk in the Augustinian order and a professor at Wittenberg University. It made him angry when German parishioners paid for indulgences and the money ended up in Italy, to make the Roman headquarters even more lavish. He had other complaints about the church, too. He felt it was very corrupt. And on October the 31st, the night before All Saints' Day, Martin Luther wrote up 98 accusations, his 95 theses. He nailed them to the door of a church in Wittenberg, and the rest is history. That started the earthquake 500 years ago this month. Luther wanted to clean up the church, not start a new church, but that's what happened. He kept writing and arguing. He had grown up as a fighter, having had a rough childhood on the streets of a mining village. He was formed by its culture of vicious insults and brutal argumentation. Imagine how this worked out for Luther when Catholic authorities called the monk to account. Their condemnation of him spurred his movement into a separate institutional identity. He gained a following among peasants first and nobles later. Indeed, it was Luther's blunt anti-authority spirit that served as part of the inspiration for the Peasants' War of 1524. Peasants demanded agrarian reform. They resisted oppression by landlords and nobles. Some leaders of the Reformation endorsed the peasants' cause. Luther, however, sided with the nobles. So the peasants lost. 100,000 people died. And if that's not bad enough, 19 years after that, he wrote a long, hateful treatise against Jewish people. Viciously, Luther urged repression of Jewish leaders and practice. And in more recent decades, Lutheran leaders in Germany, as well as other nations, have condemned Luther's antisemitism. With so much about him not to like, what was it that Luther contributed? Salvation by grace. Before the Reformation, heavenly salvation came only by merit, by your good works, by your membership in the church, and by the sacraments which only the church could offer, sacraments like baptism, last rites, and a funeral mass, among others. And in contrast to that mediating role of the church, Luther said that nothing stands between anyone and their God. Not a religious official, not a ritual. Salvation comes through personal faith. Salvation is not earned or bought, but given by God as a gift of grace. That's what he said. And this was the seismic shift of the Reformation, a shift away from institutional control into a focus on the spiritual experience of the individual person. The Reformation spirit would show up in diverse forms in many other places. And because of the never-ending innovations wrought by the spirit of the Reformation, there really is not one thing you can call Protestantism. There are many Protestantisms. We could not do justice to them in one sermon or even one book. But briefly, it's worth looking at Calvinism, which is a major branch of Protestantism. Almost 20 years after Martin Luther's German protest, John Calvin led a French Reformation. A pastor and an intellectual, John Calvin was a French-speaking figure in the city of Geneva. And in contrast to Lutheranism, Calvin's legacy is known as the Reformed tradition. And from this Reformed tradition came the Presbyterian, Dutch Reformed, and Congregational churches, among others. And those others include Unitarian Universalism. This is rather odd when you consider that the first Unitarian martyr in history was burned at the stake in 1553 at the urging of John Calvin himself. Michael Servetus was a Spanish physician, philosopher, and scientist. He was one of those passionate geniuses that other passionate geniuses just can't stand. And Calvin couldn't stand him. Servetus wrote anti-Trinitarian books, two books arguing about what the church needed to do to restore Christianity, restore the Christianity of Jesus. Somehow Servetus ended up in Geneva and was arrested. Calvin had the city council convict Servetus and burn him at the stake along with his books. These days, the city of Geneva, which is now a part of the country of Switzerland, has a monument commemorating Servetus and apologizing for his death. Sorry. Twenty-five years ago, in seminary, that is all I learned about Calvin and all I thought I needed to know. Yet last year, my dissertation advisor directed me to a book about him, and in it I learned how much of our culture has been shaped by Calvin's movement. That is, government, art, science, economics, and basic Western worldviews. Even where God and religion are not at issue, the imprint of Calvinism remains in secular society. In the words of historian Alistair McGrath, Calvinism's imprint is like the persistence of a crater in the landscape of culture when the original force of its explosion has been spent. For example, Calvinism led to a compulsion to work hard, do good, gain wealth. And the reason was not that your efforts and your success would win you God's blessing. No, in Calvinism, success was evidence that you already had God's blessing, that you were predestined for salvation. Today, the idea of A work ethic seems like an American secular trait. We admire people for it. We are praised for our work ethic. And there's no mention of God. But perhaps that compulsion or that ethic is an effort to show our desire to feel worthy. Perhaps success lures us so that we will feel better about ourselves or show ourselves to the world as better. Anyway, the work ethic is a secular expression of that legacy. Another example is, rather than retreating from the world, as some spiritual teachings do, Calvinists felt called to engage with the world in education, politics, and government. The town hall meetings of New England owe their origins to the practice of covenant in early Calvinist communities. And it was from those colonial communities that Unitarianism arose in America. And briefly, here is how. In the 1600s and 1700s, Puritan settlers ran the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and they were Calvinists. In 1648, delegates from their churches met together in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they made an agreement on how they would relate to one another. And the Cambridge Platform of 1648 said that each congregation would be governed and supported by members of the local parish. That's what we do. Though each congregation was independent, they would stay in fellowship, in covenant. They would offer help. Congregations would help each other. They would offer advice and probably scolding as they felt it was needed. It was among those churches that some liberal ministers caused a revolt known as the Unitarian Controversy in the early 1800s. And some of the ministers became Unitarian, and churches did too. They switched to liberal theology. Yet even as their theology became liberal and Unitarian, what did not change was their well-off social class or their attitudes about the world. Calvinists felt called to change the world and run it, and so did New England's Unitarians. From this legacy of Calvinism, Unitarians were engaged in civic matters of their day. Perhaps this is like the work ethic. You tried to show the goodness of your soul by being a good leader. Universalism was also a revolt against Calvinism, against its idea of predestination. In the arguments against who's predestined for hell and who's elected for heaven, they said everybody's predestined for heaven. God is love. As one UU writer has put it, universalism was predestination turned on its head. Aside from the ways the Reformation has shaped the Western world, and aside from the Reformation roots of Unitarianism, there's an even more important legacy. And this is the idea of reforming to begin with. The idea that improvement is always possible. It's called the Protestant principle. It's the idea that no endeavor is perfect. Nothing is beyond examination or criticism, including your own heritage, your own ideologies, your own opinions, your own ways of doing things. The Protestant principle was a concept of Paul Tillich. Tillich was a great liberal theologian of the 20th century. As a minister in Germany, Tillich served in the First World War as a chaplain on the battlefield. His traumatic ordeals revealed to him the demonic nature of rigid ideologies and the tragedy of us versus them thinking. After World War I, Tillich became a professor of theology in Germany. But under the Nazi regime, he was fired from his academic post. He joked that he was the first non-Jewish academic to be so honored. Tillich became a U.S. citizen in 1940, and he taught at American seminaries. To Tillich, every system of belief and every institution is imperfect. Each one of them is up for criticism, even the beliefs and institutions you love dearly. Every ideology, religious or secular, needs to be examined. The Protestant principle warns against thinking that there is one correction for all times, one singular fix. He calls that kind of thinking utopian certainty, and he says it's demonic. Now, I can imagine in the tragic and scary times in which we are living right now, most of you are not caught up in utopian certainty. Perhaps it feels like aimless confusion sometimes. Well, in addition to guarding against having the right answers or just the right fix, the Protestant principle warns us against giving up. It's not unusual for the shape of our world or the pain of our lives to lure us toward cynicism and then toward resignation. Tillich saw cynicism and resignation as the flip side of utopian certainty. This makes cynicism no less dangerous. And in between utopian certainty and cynicism and resignation is hope. We must work to be self-observant and try to be honest about what we see. Through every time of challenge or fear, this principle calls us to renew our faith in the power of love and creativity, in communities of dialogue and reflection and faith. At our best moments, we consider creative possibilities together in fellowship. We try them out, we examine the results. In community and in our own lives, we can practice keeping an open mind for new possibilities, new opportunities, and keeping an open heart for hope and love. May we move into the days ahead with an acceptance of imperfection and honesty about it. May we move into the days ahead with the courage to consider creative possibilities and opportunities. May we remember the blessing of dialogue and fellowship. May we remember the beauty and potential of every person and of all people together. So may it be. Blessed be, and amen.